exactly a year ago, almost to the day, I think it was the 25th of June last year, not the 24th, that would figure, wouldn't it? Exactly a year ago, when we had a fairly small number of folks, maybe 60, 70 people coming out to evening services here in this church, while I was still commuting, but I just gotten here and just moved here, we had a communion service, the first one we'd ever had. And when we had that communion service, which was really touched a lot of people and did a lot of made a lot of major changes in people's lives, we looked at this same passage. Now, why would I come back to it? Part of it because it's interesting to come back after a year and look at something after so much water's been under the bridge. But also because what I like about this passage is it shows that everything basically in the Bible, even a passage like this, which doesn't seem to be about him, everything in the Bible is about Jesus. Everything. And that's what we're here to talk about. In fact, in some ways, that's what the church is about. Here at the church, we're not out to bring you to a church. We're not out to bring you to a minister. We're not out to bring you to a philosophy or a style or a kind of music or anything like that, though obviously there's a lot of things about Redeemer that might be distinctive to you. We're out to bring you to Jesus. Everything is about him. The music's about him. The preaching's supposed to be about him. The church is supposed to be about him. It's all about him. It would be good for us to revisit this passage. Certainly a lot of you weren't here. In fact, what's really exciting is a lot of you were not believers this time last year. And we're going to look at this again. And let me just read this passage, just the verses 1 to 7, a weird, unusual, and extremely important passage in the history of our salvation. Chapter 17, 1 to 7. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" And then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Well, walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" And in 1 Corinthians 10, it says, "They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they all drank the same spiritual food, ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us on whom the end of the ages have come." You see, Paul very specifically says, if you want to understand the Bible, everything's about Jesus. It's written not just for them, but it's written for us, on whom the ends of the ages have come. The rock was Christ. Now, as I go on, I want you to know two other things. There's two things. The insights on this passage, I'm deeply indebted to two people about. One is C.S. Lewis, who wrote a little essay called God in the Dock. And the other one is Edmund Clowney, who's written a book called The Unfolding Mystery. And if anybody wants to know more about this, tell me afterwards, and I'll tell you where to find those things. God, in this passage, is teaching something to us. Paul says so. These things were written for us, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So, what does he say? He is teaching us three things I want here. Three things. Number one, that the world is a wilderness. God often, in the New Testament, talks about the world, the entire world, and our existence as Christians in this world as a wilderness experience. That's something that the New Testament picks up on, and it is clear as can be. The world's a wilderness. You know, our friends that went to Central Russia and saw what kind of lives those folks have lived there. There's a lot of talk about how the Baltic states are coming into freedom, and that's great, but you know, these are people that have lived virtually in slavery for ages and ages. In fact, as you look around the world and you read history, you realize, where have people been relatively free of oppression and tyranny? Where have people been relatively comfortable? Where have people been relatively free of wars and plagues and pestilence? And you begin to realize that we actually, those of us here in this country living at this time, live almost in a bubble. We live in the easiest time and place in the history and of the world. And yet, even though that we don't worry about bubonic plague, and we don't worry that much about oppressive totalitarian governments, and even though we don't worry about these things, even though we live in some ways in the most comfortable place and time in history, and yet we're all terribly unhappy, aren't we? Just about all of us. An awful lot of us are deeply unhappy too. Even in this place, in this time, the world's a wilderness. And God recognizes that. He sent his children of Israel through the wilderness, and in the New Testament constantly says, that is an example for us. That's the way we live. That is you, and I recognize that. And secondly, first of all, God shows us here the world's a wilderness. Secondly, God has opened a fountain for people in the wilderness. There is a fountain open. He knows that we will die in the wilderness unless he opens a fountain of joy, a fountain of strength, a fountain of life. So first, the world's a wilderness. Secondly, God's opened a fountain in that wilderness. And thirdly, this fountain is only available because God himself entered the wilderness himself and received our punishment, or better put, that he absorbed the suffering himself. He absorbed the judgment that evil deserved. Those are the three things you see them at the top of your sheet, right? Now, if we want to understand more about these three principles, we have to take a look at this fascinating passage. It is a juridical passage. It shows us, first of all, that there's a lawsuit lodged, and that there's a trial, and that then there's an execution. Verse 1 and 3 talks about the lawsuit. Verse 4 and 5 talks about the trial. Verse 6 and 7 talks about the execution. It's all there. Some of you who were here last year remember that. It's an incredible passage. Let's take a look at it. First, because Moses has been following the Lord's commands, they've come to a place where nobody has any water, and they're upset. They're hungry. Some of them feel like they're facing death. And because of that, they begin to rail against Moses. They're suffering, and they can't understand why they're suffering. I have a little quote down here from Dorothy Sayers in Letters to a Post-Christian World, a great quote. She says, "It seems to me quite disastrous that the idea should have gotten about that Christianity is an otherworldly, unreal, idealistic kind of religion. On the contrary, it is fiercely and harshly realistic." Put another way, no other religion, no man-made religion, and all religions but Christianity are essentially man-made. No man-made religion can figure out suffering. None of them. No man-made religion can integrate it coherently into its understanding of the world. No one. Christianity is actually the only realistic religion. And if you study other religions, you realize that other religions do not know what to do with suffering. They have got an absolutely inadequate theologies of suffering because they just don't hold up to reality. If you go over to Buddhism, if you go to the East, you will see that they will tell you that suffering is an illusion. The reason you suffer is you think that you're an individual. The reason you suffer is because you don't see that you're one with the one. You're one with all of reality, and because you think of you're an individual and you think of individual needs, you suffer. But your suffering is an illusion, and so what you have to do is get one with the one, and through meditation you get over suffering. Suffering is an illusion. Now, I don't think that's the way to deal with suffering. I don't think the way. By the way, counselors will tell you that the worst thing you can do to deal with a problem is to deny that it's there. It's an illusion, okay? That's one of the ways in marriage that people deal with conflicts. One of the ways is just to clam up and to refuse to talk about it. But the other way is to absolutely deny it and say, there's no problem. He's not really, he'll get over it. There's no sweat. And they won't talk to their spouse in a realistic way. That's not the way to deal with that, a problem. It's not the way to deal with suffering. It's the ostrich approach to suffering. If I stick my head in the sand, it's gone. It's not. I mean, in some cases, it's pretty ludicrous. Mark Twain used to make fun of Christian scientists. Christian science actually has an awful lot of Eastern understanding of suffering. And they say, you know, suffering is a matter of your thinking and mental attitude. And Mark Twain says, well, I forget, where was it? Reading one of his poems, he says, you know, I have a good friend, a Christian scientist. Every time I went over to see him last week, he said, I'm sorry I can't come out to see you because my wife thinks she's sick. And then I would go by on Monday, and on Tuesday, she said, I'm sorry, my wife thinks she's sicker. He says, finally on Wednesday, he said, I'm sorry, I can't come out today, my wife thinks she's dead. And he would make a lot of fun of that. And of course, you know, it is something you can make fun of. But he caught up with you. Mark Twain was a humorist, it's supposed to be fun, but of course it was rather black humor. That's not the way to deal with suffering. Now there's another way to deal with it. And Western religions, including Islam, by and large, deal with it this way. It's the religion, and I'd say a majority almost of Christians that I know deal with it like this too. It's the theology of Job's friends. Job's friends said, suffering is really not a mystery. Good people, God gives good lives to. Bad people, God sends suffering to. If you're suffering, you must be bad. If you're not suffering, it means you're pleasing God, you know. And that's why we have little jokes about it, right? So if, for example, something goes well, or you win the lottery, or something goes your way, you say what? I must be living right. That's the theology of Job's friends. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, at least it acknowledges the reality of suffering, but it doesn't work. I went to a place, I forget when this was, last spring I heard a very, very wealthy man who's a fine Christian fella get up and give what I considered a fairly misleading illustration. He told a true story about himself. And when he was just a young buck still coming up, and he wasn't a triple billionaire the way he is now, and when he was coming up in life, at one point he was with the boss, and the boss told him a dirty joke. And as a good Christian, this man sat there and refused to crack a smile. And the boss, who was a very bawdy person anyway, said, what's the matter? Don't like that joke? Don't think it's funny? And he says, no, sir, I don't think it's funny. I think it's a dirty joke, and I don't think it's funny at all. And so the guy sort of chewed on a cigar. You can see this story. And he says, you got guts. And within a month, he had a major promotion on his hand, and on he went. And he says, you see? You know, just stick to your guns and do the right thing, and God will take care of you. And I know for a fact that there are people who have tried that, and that month they lost their job. Every bit as godly as that fellow. The theology of Job's friends doesn't work. And Christianity alone understands the wilderness. Christianity alone has not only acknowledges that good people suffer, not only acknowledges that here's Peter in prison and he prays, and you know, his friends pray, and he's sprung by angels. Hey, that's the way it's supposed to be. Here's John the Baptist in prison, and probably his followers pray for him, and he's beheaded. Wait a minute. Huh? Wait. But you see, Christianity doesn't have a problem with that, because at the very heart of it, not at the periphery, it's not something in your little theology books that say, oh yeah, here's a couple ideas on why the good suffer. At the heart of the Christianity is the best man, in fact, the only good man in history, suffered undeservedly. And through it, God brought forth the kingdom of God. I mean, you know, the idea of good people experiencing undeserved suffering is downtown Christianity. It's right in the center. It's not at the periphery. And therefore, suffering that comes into our lives does not just come into the lives of bad people, but it comes in the lives of all kinds of people. And it doesn't come necessarily with rhyme or reason, except that we know that when it comes, it's because God is trying to do something redemptive in us, just like he did with God, with Jesus. Same thing. And that's why, for example, God says the Israelites, his treasured possession, the people he loves the most. He says, remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you and to know what was in your heart. To teach you, man does not live by bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. What's that mean? It means that if suffering comes into your life, it can have a wonderful effect on you, but it doesn't have to. In fact, suffering will polarize you. That means that when suffering comes into your life, or any suffering, a big one or a little one, there's a crossroads there, and it will either make you a harder, nastier person, a more bitter, sad person, or it will make you a godlier, greater, more loving, more tender-hearted, more compassionate person, but it will not leave you where you were. You cannot stay where you were. No way. Put it another way. When suffering comes into your life, either you use it to make God look big in your eyes, and you become small, so you depend on Him and love Him and serve Him. In other words, either suffering will lead you to stand before Him humbly, or your suffering will turn you into someone quite proud and hard. In other words, suffering could make you big in your eyes, make you self-absorbed, make you full of self-pity, and next thing you know, instead of it magnifying God in your eyes and you standing humbly before Him, you have magnified yourself in your eyes, and you are summoning God to stand before you.